Today I'm interviewing Dubliner Fergus O'Gorman. He is 85 years young. He has been 8 times to the Antarctic, and his current book, Antarctic Affair, tells his story of his fascination of this white, cold, remote and hostile continent. His love affair goes back now over 65 years, and he ain't finished yet. He is an award-winning TV and radio presenter, and he is a member of the Forever Young Club. Well, Fergus, where did it all begin? How did you guess the stream of Antarctica?
Well, it was all due to a book which my brother gave me, my only brother and elder brother, and he said, you should read this, Southwith Scott.
Great book.
Yeah. And I read it and was fascinated by it. And I said to him, I was 14, I said, I want to be an explorer. And he said, well, to be an explorer, you have to be a scientist nowadays. And I said, well, what's science? I knew nothing about science. And having survived the Christian Brothers, I went to UCD and signed up for science, physics, maths, all of whom were my worst possible subjects, and zoology. And I'd never done any zoology. That was not for boys, you know. That's so. By the time I got past first year, I knew I wanted to be a zoologist. And I then did geology, as I thought that would be a way to getting out into the wide world, you know. And I saw an ad for a meteorologist in the Antarctic. So I replied, and never heard, of course, another thing. The following year, I saw a similar ad, and there were several other ads for astrophysics, and I applied for them. And this was the British government official program. It was called the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey. So the people were known as FIDS as a result. And we are still known as FIDS, in fact. So I graduated, heard nothing. And I suppose I graduated in June. And at the end of July, a telegram arrived. Wow. You only got telegrams when people died, sort of thing.
I was just about to say it. I was saying, who died?
Yes. And because communications were rather different from nowadays, you know, we didn't have a telephone. We only could listen to the radio, no television. And so the telegram arrived on a Friday evening, and I was to come to London for an interview for a job as a meteorologist on the Monday morning. So I had to scurry across the Irish Sea, which I had never done before, and make my way to London for an interview on the Monday morning. When it came to the end of the interview, I said, well, am I getting the job? And they said, well, you know nothing about meteorology, but we have a job for a biologist. Would you be interested? And I said, yes. And I said, what sort of a job, biology job? And they said, studying fur seals. Now, I hadn't got a clue. I mean, I'd seen a seal in the zoo, in the Dublin Zoo, but I knew nothing about fur seals. And I said, well, how much are you going to pay? And they said, well, we pay, you'll get £8 a week, which even in those days was miserably. But saying it as you're a graduate, we'll pay you £9. So that was the start of it.
So then you went on your way, you got the job.
I got the job.
And you were going to the place of your dream, Antarctica. So can you tell us a little bit about that journey? Because like at that stage, 65 years ago, Antarctica was one of the most remote, the most desolate, the most unforgiving places on planet Earth.
We boarded the Royal Research Ship Shackleton in Southampton on October the 1st of that year and headed off into the Atlantic. And there was, it took us 39 days to get to Montevideo. There was engine problems. I'd never been, needless to say, in South America, and the continent was blissful because, of course, Mediterranean climate. So you are as if you are in Spain. Not that I'd ever been in Spain, but so we hung around there for a while, and finally they sorted out the ship's problems, and we headed down south to the Falkland Islands, which, as you know, is just off the end of Patagonia. There we were equipped. Equipped is hardly the word for it, but we got ex-army boots and ex-army gear, which had been accumulated from the war, and back on the boat and headed for Antarctica.
And okay, do you know, now you're on your way to Antarctica, your age what at this stage?
I'm age 22 at this stage.
22.
I'd had a birthday in Montevideo.
Very good. So here we are now, like, and I can just visualise it. Antarctica, the coldest, most remote places and the roughest seas in the world. Can you tell us your first impression? What did it actually feel like, a 22-year-old, following in the footsteps of probably Shackleton and Tom Crean? I don't even know if you knew of Tom Crean at the time.
No.
Or indeed Shackleton.
Oh, well, Shackleton, yes. The ship was called the Shackleton.
Yeah.
So at least we knew that much. We went southeast from the Falklands and for South Georgia, which is the first islands you meet, and it is so dramatic. I'd never been in the Alps. I'd never seen glaciers. It's as if you cut the top 10,000 feet off the Himalayas and dropped them in the sea. It was so dramatic. And we pulled in there. This was a British possession, which the Argentines, of course, had their eye on, and there was a lot of whaling going on at that time. So there were six whaling stations. Having stacked up whatever, we brought a lot of goods to the island. And
Was this your base now?
No. This is just a stopping point. That was my first introduction to Antarctic conditions.
Yeah, and I could see this was amazing because I've been there myself.
Yeah.
These massive mountains is where Shackleton and Crean actually crossed to save their men.
Yeah.
And then from there, where, like, you know, like, was your mind blown at this stage, like, you know,
well,
as a young 22-year-old?
Well, I mean, if this was what we were going to meet down on the continent, it would be wow. Oh, totally wow. And so we set off south to the South Orkneys, where I was supposed to spend the next 2.5 years. And
on your own, or had you people now on the ship that were going to be with
you? Well, there was a base there on the, in the South Orkneys, and that's where these nine men, including myself, were going to spend the winter and the following years. But as it turned out, they had organised a survey party, which was going to a smaller one of the South Orkneys, and I was to be included on that.
Can I just ask, you know, like, because I think we missed something here. South Orkney is like, it's a lot more south. This is a remote place. If you think South Georgia is remote, this is even more remote.
Yes.
What did you now feel like? Did you have any friends? Did you have, you know, what did you see? What did you feel? Like, you're going to be landed here for 3 years, like.
Yeah. Well, if you think of the continent, I mean, of South America and the Antarctic continent, the Andes come down, the length of South America, but when they get to the bottom in Patagonia, they do a big loop, and the sea full of ice, pack ice, in other words, sea ice that had been there in the winter and had accumulated over several years, maybe as much as 10 years before it broke up. And so that we had to plow our way through this broken pack ice to get to the base, this British base on the South Orkneys. So having arrived there, there was an existing base with 10 or more people on it. And some of those were leaving. We were coming in new. But as it turned out, I was only going to spend one night on the base. In fact, I shouldn't have been on the base, because the following morning we were going to another island where we were to be dropped as a survey party, and I was attached to the survey party so that I could chase fur seals or find fur seals or do something with fur seals if there were any.
So the adventure began.
Yes.
And were you camping? Were you hutting?
No. We were camping. We were to be there 3 months in tents, and there were five of us. We had only just started to get organised to do the survey when we discovered that the Shackleton, the ship which we had come on, had hit a piece of ice just after they had dropped us and was sinking. And the Royal Navy fortunately came along and rescued them. So
you nearly went down before you started.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the Titanic.
And in fact, I had a big headline in the Sunday Independent. Irishman in dramatic event in the Antarctic, even though I wasn't on the boat, you know. So my mother was opened the door, and flashing bulbs and a reporter saying, "Have you heard about your son? Is he alive?" You know, and she knew nothing, of course, about this. So anyway, fortunately, I wasn't there, and nobody got lost.
Just as a question, because you were going away to the most remote place on planet Earth at the time, what did your family feel? Your mother, that loved you, like, you know, and seeing this son of hers, like, you know, did she give you a blessing? And did she say, like, "Oh, my son's gone to Antarctic"?
No.
What was her feeling?
No. I mean, I had previously I'd been offered an athletic scholarship to the USA, and she refused point blank to let me go. Well, I was 15 or 16 at the time, and so when I did my degree, and I said the telegram arrived, and then I got the job. I said, "Right, I'm going." You know,
Now she's facing cameras and they're flickering and the endurance or the Shackleton is going down. Her son is down in the Antarctic. She can't even communicate with you, I presume, at this stage.
Oh, totally. No communication.
Oh, what was the communication?
Well, she ultimately heard from the head office that we were all safe. That was all she heard.
So had you a satellite phone that you could ring back every
week? No, not at all.
So tell me about...
The only communication was by radio.
Yeah?
Yeah. And...
So did you ring home every week to tell her you were safe?
Oh, not at all. I mean, we weren't allowed use the equipment to ring anybody. In fact, the regulation said that you could have 5 minutes conversation with your family every 6 months. So in other words, twice a year.
So now you mean to tell me you're down in Antarctica, you can only go on the phone to your family...
Well, it's not the phone, it's
the
radio.
The radio, the VHF. Yeah. And like, that must have been traumatic for your mother to see her son just head off in 5 minutes every 6 months.
Well, she didn't know that. She never expected to hear, I think, anything. But when the phone, when they came through, they arranged that they got a radio connection. Antarctica is a dangerous place if you put a foot wrong. In my second year, one of my the friends who had come down and who had supposedly was going to be my assistant in the field, but because of what happened, the Shackleton he was diverted. We joined up together in the South Shetlands. The South Orkneys, South Sandwich, South Shetlands, and then you're on the peninsula and the continent. I was running this three-man event for 3 months on an island called Livingston, which is one of the South Shetlands. Alan, who was this chap...
what was his full name?
Alan Sharman.
And this is your friend now?
Yes, yeah. Okay. He was one of the, there was only three of us. Pete Hodgkinson was the other. And we spent 3 months on this island camping and travelling around trying to survey fur seal and manhauled the sledges because we didn't have huskies or anything. Around this island, which is about 120 miles long by 10 or 15 miles wide.
And you were saying this was your second year in. Yes. Did you actually say there was an accident with some of your friends?
Like, yes. Well,
so what happened there?
Well, Alan, who was this particular friend of mine, who was sharing this summer survey work, when we finished on that island, he was moved by the Royal Navy to another island in the South Shetlands where he was going to spend the winter. And I was going back to the South Orkneys. Within 6 weeks of us departing, he was dead.
How do you mean dead? What happened?
He went out for a walk with one of the other base members and two huskies on apparently a Sunday, and they climbed up an icy slope, got knocked down by the huskies who couldn't make it because of the icy conditions, and both of them slid down this icy slope, Alan head first and the other chap feet first, and there was a cliff, a 30-foot cliff at the end, and they both went over the cliff. Alan crashed onto the rocks below and his head was split open and he died instantly, or at least from the
time
afterwards.
Was that traumatic for you, or was it an acceptable... outcome of people being in the Antarctic?
Oh, no, so we, I mean, there were always deaths. In fact, the British tally now is 29 dead. The latest one being the first woman in 2003. But it was a well-known hazard. But the trauma was enormous. When I was in on the base in the South Orkneys, and the message came through on the radio that Alan had been killed, and the radio operator came and said, "Alan Sherman was killed yesterday," and I was totally gobsmacked, as you can imagine. And so was everybody else, of course. So that became a major emotional exercise. I left the hut. I walked across the ice cap to the penguin rookery, as this was in the summer, and I sat there for 4 or 5 hours trying to cope with the fact that Alan was dead and that this was a dangerous place. I mean, we knew it was dangerous, but until you get a tragedy like that, you don't know how dangerous. And in fact, one of our mutual friends, within 2 months in the same base as Alan was killed by falling in a crevasse. And he survived the fall, but when they put down a rope to him, he was down about 60 feet, and they couldn't pull him up because the difficulties. So they hitched up a husky team to the rope, which dragged him up to the lip of the crevasse.
So he was just getting out?
Yes, he was just getting out. His hands were on the lip and his belt broke.
What?
He had threaded the rope through his belt instead of putting it around his body. And so he fell straight down and went down 120 feet. End of story.
What impact did those events have on you still wanting to be an explorer?
Well, I was now an explorer. I was there. There was nothing I could do about it. I mean, I suppose in this day and age, everybody would have been put on a plane and sent home, you know. But there was no way. We had no communication. The ship came in November or December and called again in April as it was going back to the UK. And that was the only you couldn't get off an island or a base, except on those two occasions.
In your own mind, did it make you want it more?
Well, I was there. There was no question of me going home. I had a job to do, and I had to survive. And that was it just heightens your resolve that you would take sufficient care of yourself and your companions that it wouldn't happen again.
And Fergus, at that stage, did you become introverted, or was there, what was the feeling down there of, were you lonely? Were you?
Yes, well, I mean,
no,
for instance, I mean, that death was announced. Those two deaths were announced But nobody ever spoke about them. We never had a discussion. We just were totally isolated. And my feelings about it were that it has happened, I had to survive. And I was totally isolated. I was a minuscule spot on the map of Antarctica that nobody else mattered if I was going to survive. And that, so you emotionally, you had to overcome that and concentrate on surviving and doing your job, of course.
And emotionally between the men, was there like a bond of feeling of camaraderie, love, you know?
Well, there was no question of love. I mean, in fact, the only way you could feel love in the Antarctic was to go out and hug a husky, you know, because they were there. We used them for all travelling purposes. And they were, so all your emotions were either in your head or grabbing a husky, you know, but there was no suggestion of any other affections being passed on between the members. We sympathized with Alan and Tink, who was the other person. His family, but we just carried on.
So there's no emotional sense, there was no time to feel the trauma, to feel the recovery.
No,
it
nor,
just happened and that's it, move on.
Yes, we didn't even have a ceremony about their deaths.
And where were they buried?
Well, they were buried where they died, on the island in the South Shetlands.
Okay. So, like you were saying there about emotion, because I find it very strange, like, you know, like, and to be 3 years away, no emotions, no feelings with anybody, and here you have huskies, like, and dogs are amazing. They say they're man's best friend. So, can you tell us a little bit about, I suppose I'm fascinated about, like, what you eat, what you drank, where you went to the toilet, you know, like, what the emotions are, and... You know, because I just think like people are fascinated with Antarctica. A lot of people can't even visualize the contrast of the whites. But like the huskies, can you tell us a little bit about what the huskies were doing, Witchy?
Well, they had come from Labrador originally, taken down, so that they would provide a service to the all the survey teams. So if you were in the field, obviously the huskies pulled all the tents and all the food and everything else for you, and you skied alongside them. And they were a tremendous resource in that sense, and also in the sense that they were alive and were affectionate. If they hadn't killed one another, I mean, they were always fighting. There was a hierarchy among them.
So it looks like you became very emotional and attached to these...
Oh, yes, yeah.
...huskies.
Yeah.
But, you know, what happens, like, do they move with you, or say, like... If you're on an island and you're moving to another island, do all the dogs move? Or was there ever a time like that you had to deal with the death of a husky?
Yes. Yeah. I was on an island in the south. After the survey in the South Shetlands, I was dropped into an extinct crater, which was Deception Island, to await a pickup a couple of months later. And there was a husky team there, and we got orders from headquarters to eliminate them.
How do you mean eliminate them?
Yes, because they were surplus to requirements. Nobody wanted them. No, we couldn't feed them because there were no seals, and mostly we fed our huskies on seals. And because I was the biologist, I was told to shoot the seals in the first case, but in this case there was no seals. I was told to shoot the huskies.
What?
Yes, eliminate them, in fact. And I had a...
And these were your friends, like, these were the people that actually loved you. And, you know, this is where you were getting your affection from.
Yeah, sure.
What did you do?
Well, ultimately, I was threatened with being taken out by the next ship if I didn't shoot them. And so I took my... There were seven of them. I took the one that I was... I had best regards for and who was the friendliest. I decided that he would have to be the first one, so I took him up to the rim of the crater, which was about a couple of miles walk across the glacier, etc., and up to the limb. And I had been given a 303 rifle, and I sat him down on the edge overlooking the crater, and he wagged his tail at me, and I shot him, and then put the body over the cliff, and he went directly into the sea, which was a relief that he didn't crash out. Not that it made any difference, but so I had to do that seven times. That
my
journey.
God, how did I feel? Like, you know, like, what, they must have been looking up at you, like. Like, is it our best friend? And
yeah.
And, like, you have to take a gun and
dreadful,
shoot them.
Dreadful. Dreadful. I wept. And, you know, young men don't weep, as you know.
Well, I don't know, like, but tell us that feeling.
Yes, it was dreadful. I had started before lunch, so I missed my lunch. I came back late for dinner. I didn't eat dinner. And nobody on the base ever mentioned the Huskies to me or again. There wasn't a single word of condolence or anything.
But emotionally for you, you must have been a wreck.
Yeah, I was, yeah. In fact, the following day, I set out across the rim of the glacier to visit the Argentine base. There was an Argentine base about 3 or 4 miles away. And without taking any precautions, I got there. I probably was hoping that I would fall in a crevasse and not get out, you know. I don't know whether I'm just making that up, but at least I got to the Argentine base, and they were always so nice, you know, hospitable. And not only that, but they had real steaks, which you couldn't get on the British base. We had only frozen meat or a penguin or a seal.
Yeah.
So I stayed there for a couple of days and came back to the base eventually when I felt capable.
Yeah, I could see that this would have been a very, like, you know... Like
I can still feel it.
You know, you know what I get a feeling for here now, like, is the, you know, the initial stages with Amundsen, you know, like when he with his huskies to the pole, and then he, like, you know, whereas Scott wouldn't shoot the animals.
Yes.
And eat them, like, right, Amundsen got there, he shot them, but he didn't alone shoot them, he ate them as well.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm just thinking...
And fed his other dogs.
And fed his other dogs with the dogs, you know, like, and then I get the visualization of Tom Crean, who we all love as, you know yourself, and a the affection he gave... Yeah, and the affection he gave the dogs, and to think you were the same caliber and you had to shoot those dogs, you know, like, that was traumatic. But I suppose it is all part of nature. The other thing that fascinates me is you were there at the early exploration side and your living accommodations and how he ate, you know. What did you eat?
Well, of course, all the food had to come in frozen, basically, or dried. In those days, freeze-dried, that sort of thing. We had... all the meat was frozen or dried, so that they expected you to live off the land. In other words, shoot seals and eat them, shoot penguins and eat them, or anything else you would catch. There was an abundance of fish, and we fished. And one of the members who wintered with me was a superb cook, in fact, and he used to get up at 6 in the morning. We took a week on and week off turns, you know, for being a cook or doing the housework, etc. And on his week, he got up at 6, made fresh rolls, having raised the yeast, etc., for breakfast, went out and fished in the holes in the sea ice and caught fresh fish, which we had for lunch or dinner or both. And that was, you know, superb, in fact. Otherwise, we ate penguins. We ate, because I was studying seals, and I shot a lot of seals, and also because we were shooting seals to feed the huskies. So we ate...
So you ate well?
Well, we ate, yes. A lot of people didn't like eating seal. I must say, seal brains never appealed to me.
Yeah, it wouldn't appeal to me either, really. But, like, the other side of it, like, which actually always fascinates me, is the fact that along winters,
yeah,
you know, the darkness, the depression,
yeah,
you know, they say people that go there, they suffer a lot from depression in the sense of not having the light. What? How did you entertain yourself? Or?
Well, there was very little, there was radio, of course, but in fact, we, surprisingly, it was felt that entertainment was only at the weekend. So, we had free access to alcohol, but we only drank it on Saturday evening. And as I was a teetotaler, as a result of being in Christian Brothers, I was...
I'm getting to know you. Has that changed?
Yes, well, but that's another story. So I was very popular. My ration went to the lads, you know. But, no, there wasn't very much entertainment, I must say.
Yeah.
We had parties at birthdays, you know, and Christmas and midwinter, of course, was a big time for a party.
Yeah, and, you know, sleep-wise, never a problem to you, Fergus?
No, not at all, not at all. Except I used to, quite often in the winter, because we had, the only heating was coal, you couldn't put a fire in the dormitory, we had dormitory, unless the temperature was below freezing in the in the house. So you got into bed and you put extra all your clothes on in the bed, and you got up in the morning and you took them off. So that was one way of keeping warm. But several times, quite often, in fact, I used to wake up with a whole pile of ice crystals on my chest. Why, I never discovered until it turned out that there was a crack in the double glazing and it was coming in, this moisture was coming in and blowing across the dorm. I happened to be in the direct route and I got it. So you ended up with faces covered in ice and the sleeping bag with snow on it.
Yeah, they're amazing stories. And what happened when you came back? Like, did you have a family? Like, you know, I believe you're a father of eight.
Yes, yes.
No, which is fascinating in itself. Yeah. And you still kept going back seven more times to the Antarctic.
Yes.
Can you fill us a small bit in about your personal life or your...
Yes. In the process of, after the Shackleton had hit the ice, my summer program was disrupted and I was sent to Montevideo to work on the fur seals there, because they had a fur seal colony and had an industry. And needless to say, I met the only Irish family in Uruguay, and Tom Scott from El Fin had two daughters, one of whom I ultimately married.
Go away.
Yes. She came back to London. I was working in the headquarters of the British Antarctic Survey for a couple of years after the event, getting home, and we got married.
And how many children?
And we moved to Cork. I mean,
that's a great place to move, by the way.
Absolutely, it was heaven.
Yeah.
So, ultimately, I've had eight children, but the interesting bit is that they have had five fathers and four mothers. And
one.
And that stomachs people blink, say, I wonder how he did that, you know, but...
I'm sure you're going to tell us. First.
Yes, I am. Sheila and I adopted three children in Cork. I moved to Dublin, we moved to Dublin. I became a scientific advisor in the Department of Forestry and Lands, setting up the wildlife national parks business. And regrettably, Sheila died on holiday in Africa with us. And I ultimately remarried a widow with three children. So that's... We both had two children, so that accounts for the five fathers and four mothers.
Very good. So that's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know your love affair continued with the Antarctic, and in actual fact, you were one of my inspirations in some of the stuff I have done down there. And I think, you know, there was one incident, like you know, you're 85... You just keep on going back down. And we have a very special person here sitting across from us as well, which I might ask. You decided to get married in the Antarctic at 83.
Yes.
And Denise, like, if you want to come over and pull in a chair and, you know, tell us about this, because this is an amazing story, like, you know, about love on the ice.
Well, Fergus and I were introduced possibly 15 years ago now. And everything was going very nicely. We were living in Dublin, living together. I suppose the old saying used to be living in sin, but that day is gone. But we were actually living in Dublin and life was good. And Fergus had asked me, would I like to go to the Antarctic on a trip? But actually, I had heard a lot about the Antarctic from Fergus, and I just felt, you know, it was a very expensive thing to do, and I was working at the time. And the first time he suggested it, I didn't go. But he came back 2 years later and again asked, would I go to the Antarctic? And this time I was very energised, because the tour was called a tour
in memoriam.
And basically it was a tour where a group of 86 of us went down and visited the bases where some of the scientists had died. And I suppose after the deaths, as Fergus has described in the interview, where there was no recognition that these people had died and there was no chance for grieving, now it was recognised that these men deserve to be honoured. So what this expedition was about was honouring the men of science who had gone to the Antarctic and had given up their lives so that we could understand the world better. And so the expedition was going to these bases, and there was going to be a plaque put on each base where somebody had died with their name and with that statement that they gave their lives so that we could honour, we could understand the world better. So that really appealed to me. I thought that was really a very important thing to do. So I decided I'd go off to the Antarctic with Fergus. So off we went, and we were having a very, very nice time.
Can I just
time.
Come in here?
Yeah?
Fergus, that you didn't know, had something else in mind. Fergus, can you tell us what you did before, like her, Denise not knowing, so not her, Denise not knowing about the ring and...
Oh, yeah. The first time she refused to go, I had already bought the ring for the wedding. And I said, we're going to get wed. I said to myself, we're going to get wed in the Antarctic.
And Pat.
So she refused to come. And I still carried the ring. But the when we got on the boat in Ushuaia, in Patagonia, to go to the Antarctic, I said to the captain, I want us to, that when we get to the furthest south that this ship will go, I want to get onto the land and have a marriage ceremony with Denise. And I said, it's a secret. So so when we got there, he said to me, by the way, Fergus, we'll arrive at our most southerly point this evening. And I said, right, organise a rubber boat that we could go ashore and you come. And he could do the ceremony. So I then decided that it was the right time to ask her. So I took her out onto the front.
Sorry, this is very important. What age were you?
Well, it's only 2 years ago.
That's what
it?
I was saying. You were 83, like.
I was 83.
He was 83.
Yeah.
Now, okay, you're going to propose to this woman.
Yeah.
An icebreaker, a semi-icebreaker.
Yeah.
Okay, go.
Right, so I took her out to the bow, and it was a really nasty evening with snow blowing and ice on the ship and everything else. And she was very reluctant to come out, but I said, we must see this, you must see this. And I went down on my knee and proposed to her. And her response was, you must be joking.
That is the fact. I did say, you must be joking. I was completely, completely taken off guard. And I had to think very, very fast. He did explain that he had organised that we'd get married the following day on Horseshow Island, and you know, that this was his plan. So after saying that he must be joking, I thought quite fast, and you know, we had been living together and were committed to each other. So my response very quickly was, well, no, I'm not happy to get married, but I would love to have a ceremony of commitment. So that's what we did. The following morning, off we were brought in the rubber dinghy over to Horseshoe Island, and the captain, whose legal rights
George was the captain's name, and he leaned over to me as we went ashore, and he said, you realise, Fergus, that when we get ashore, all my legal powers will be lost, because the only powers I have are on the ship. And I said, perfect.
Mm. Well, it was really... It was quite lovely. I suppose you could say, and the bride wore wellies, because she actually did. And
so we went through the ceremony anyway.
This ceremony happened.
A wedding ceremony. The whole
penguins stood around and
absolutely
clapped their wings.
And a few seals. Some of the ladies on board had made a little bouquet of flowers out of white serviettes and edged them, made roses out of them and edged them with a little bit of pink nail varnish. So it was quite cute. And we had a lovely celebration. And yeah, sure, we've been celebrating since, actually, because life is good.
And living off it. Well, I must say, like, it's an amazing story. You know, the Antarctic Affair, I'm sure, is going to be an amazing book. It's something that I've been waiting for a long time for you to do. I want to wish you the best. But before we go, now that you're 85, what advice would you give the people, like, you know, like all those years ago at 20, in the early years of polar exploration, like you were in there, you know, what nuggets would you advise, say, the likes of myself, you know, like, because a lot of people, as they get older, have fear. And then if you look back at your 60-year-old self, like, what would you tell yourself? And if you look back to your 20-year-old self, what would you tell yourself? And is it different?
I think what I started out with has been maintained. In other words, an intense curiosity to find out what the next step would take, whatever. And that if you are curious and go for it, you develop skills which are appropriate, and that's what happened to me. I mean, I never expected to be a scientist, but I ended up being a scientist, and it allowed me to go around the world, work with the UN, work with the Irish government, work with all sorts of people, but you need to be prepared to be curious and to go for it.
Well, that's been fascinating. I just want to thank Denise for sharing her story of love on the ice and your, you know, fascinating story. I want to thank you, Fergus, for all your inspiration over the years on Antarctica to myself and many other people, which I know you have. You've had an amazing life, like, you know, from TV presenter, radio presenter, you know, operating in the UN, UNESCO, the stuff that you set up, you know, even being a columnist in the early 80s with the Tribune, like, you know, I'm with Gareth and Van Gelderen, like, you know, which was an amazing time as well. But I just want to say thank you. Keep living. I'd like to thank Fergus and Denise for what was an amazing interview. We all have an Everest, no matter who we are. Do you know what yours is? Do you know what you want out of life? And are you ready to make that a reality?
Why not join our tribe of Forever Young Club members, dreamers, doers and achievers, and be inspired to live the life that you know that you deserve? For more information, why not contact us on www.pathvalvi.com and also sign in and subscribe to our podcast. Thank you very much.